Radio.
Resisting the Pedagogy of Dwarves, a talk by Scott Stevens, online editor of ABC Religion and Ethics. This talk was recorded as part of the Scholarship in the Cathedral lecture series, an initiative of the Notre Dame Centre for Faith, Ethics and Society in Sydney. This series was recorded in a collaboration between Cradio and XT3.
It is a great, great pleasure to be here, and I'm especially grateful to Sandra Lynch and Matt Beard and Father Richard Umbers for the kind invitation to be here, and it's just wonderful, quite simply, to be here with you all. So thank you for coming out on a Friday night, and hopefully I'll say a few things at least that might intrigue you, if not really, really irritate you, but let's see how we go. In 1943, the Second World War had not yet reached its final act. That would have to wait until the middle of the following year, June 1944. Nevertheless, by 1942, 1943, it seemed as though the worst of the Nazi aggression had passed. It seemed that Germany's military gains had at least began to be rolled back in Eastern Europe and North Africa. This at least seemed like enough for some of the more significant minds of theologians and religiously minded intellectuals in Europe, well, at least those living outside of Germany, to begin turning their minds from the brutal reality of war as such to what it was that might come after the war. What culture would emerge in the West after the tide of war had receded? It's quite fascinating to me because this incredibly intense series of reflections began to emerge late 1942 until about the middle of 1943. The cluster of reflections, of writings that came out during that period is extremely interesting. Let me just take a couple. So, for instance, Simone Weil in 1943, which was, of course, the final year of her life, despaired that a regime of rights, which already was beginning to be widely discussed, she despaired that a regime of rights could not provide the newly vulnerable European minorities with the necessary protection from the sheer immensity of violence to which they'd recently been exposed. And so instead, she attempted in her draft for a Statement of Human Obligation of 1943 to erect a kind of absolute conception of human obligation. All humans, by virtue of being humans, can exert a universal obligation on all other humans. She was already feeling, interestingly enough, that rights just doesn't cut it. You can't have rights without some kind of transcendental frame of reference. In 1943, Henri de Lubac, of course, completed his magnificent drama of atheistic humanism. But for me, it was his stunning essay entitled Spiritual Warfare that most poignantly warned against the church succumbing to the temptation to gaze longingly, enviously, at the strength of a kind of resurgent popular neo-paganism. I mean, that's, of course, what Nazism was. It was neo-paganism. And it was neo-paganism that emerged and began flexing its muscles and in many respects filled a kind of cultural gap that had long been vacated by a robust Christianity. Henri de Lubac was convinced that the great temptation was for the church to begin looking at that type of neo-pagan strength and say, that's what we need to emulate a little bit more. De Lubac, of course, warned that by attempting to overcome Christianity's apparent powerlessness by means of neo-pagan strength, what that would thereby do is betray the gospel of love. The seemingly powerless gospel of love, of course. Finally, Jacques Maritain, in a manner that reflected his own sort of schizophrenic split between France and the United States. Maritain, at this stage, was already moving back and forth. Jacques Maritain, in his tract, Christianity and Democracy, made a call for a kind of heroic humanism that would ward off, quote, the age of the masses and shapeless multitudes nourished and brought into subjection and led to the slaughter by infamous demigods. These are all quite striking warnings that emerged in 1943 against what might come after war. But to my mind, as important as these different warnings were, there were two rather unlikely responses that emerged from outside the cauldron of the European theater that really captured the nature of the post-war threat most prophetically, most presciently. In late 1942, W.H. Auden wrote a brief article for the Chicago Sun entitled Poetry and Total War. In that article, he expressed his concern that in order to combat the threat of fascism, democracies would end up having to construct an anti-fascist political religion. A political religion that in turn would subsume the entirety of cultural life. He referred to it as a kind of soft totalitarianism. Later that same year, Auden would give this political religion poetic form. He would flesh it out, describe it. And in fact, he gave it the name of a renewed Caesarism. Caesarism in his great Christmas Oratio for the time being. In the fourth volume, I'm sure we're close enough to Christmas, and I'm sure you spent a good deal of the holiday period rereading W.H. Auden's Christmas for the time being. If not, I mean, seriously, shame on you. That should be part of your observance. In fact, it's Lent. For goodness sake, just devote the rest of Lent to reading W.H. Auden's for the time being. In the fourth part of that poem, the great fugal chorus chants, "Great is Caesar." For the time being is if you're not familiar with it, it's a retelling of the Christmas narrative, but set in eerily modern times. There's no other way of describing it than that. The journey of the wise men is interrupted by this fugal chorus. It's a band of unnamed, no-faced, disembodied voices that begin idolatrously chanting the greatness of Caesar. This fugal chorus chants, "Great is Caesar, for he has conquered seven kingdoms." And then one by one, they lay out, they begin charting, as it were, Caesar's freshly conquered territory. These different kingdoms are called the Kingdom of Abstract Idea, which goes on, as you can tell, he's describing a kind of epistemological positivism. Then comes the Kingdom of Natural Cause, a form of efficient rationalism. Then comes the Kingdom of Infinite Number, a particular form of mathematic logicism derived from Gottlob Frege. And then comes, and here's where it gets really interesting, then comes the Kingdom of Credit Exchange, namely market economy. Then comes the Kingdom of Inorganic Giants, the ubiquity of the machine as the final piece in the overcoming of nature, the machine from the tank, to the train, to the automobile, to the crane, to the gun. The Kingdom of Inorganic Giants, I think that's wonderful. Then comes the Kingdom of Organic Dwarves. And the Kingdom of Organic Dwarves is the pharmaceutical industry. If you don't feel good, it'll make you feel better. And then finally, most chillingly, comes the Kingdom of Popular Soul, namely the achievement of total popular consent. Let me read you briefly from the poem. When he, referring to Caesar, says, "You are happy," we laugh. When he says, "You are wretched," we cry. When he says, "It is true," everyone believes it. When he says, "It is false," no one believes it. When he says, "This is good," then this is loved. When he says, "This is bad," then this is hated. Great is Caesar. God must be with him. Caesar's conquering of these various domains ends up yielding total consent. When Caesar dictates the rules, then everybody almost pantomimes their response. Auden's vision, of course, should be very familiar to us, because this is the culture we inhabit. This is the air that we breathe. This is liberalism's promised dominion over nature, its scientific desolation of the sacred, its technological, machinic, and economic suppression of every natural limit, its pharmacological triumph over every physical weakness, all in the service of the provision of unhindered individual freedom. A freedom, however, that when we exercise it, reveals itself as the opposite of real human individuality. This false individuality takes the form of a kind of cloying conformist banality. It's a magnificent poem, and Auden got it absolutely right, what was coming. But Auden's not the person I want to focus on tonight. There was something else that was written just mere months after Auden completed For the Time Being. In February 1943, C.S. Lewis delivered the Riddell Memorial Lectures over three evenings at King's College at the University of Durham. His chosen topic was a rather strange one. Now, can I just say, I'm no C.S. Lewis sycophant. I'm not even really a C.S. Lewis fan. I grew up with people that idolized him and pored over every word that he wrote and quoted him as if it were the Bible. I actually grew up quite loathing C.S. Lewis. I actually never thought the Narnia Chronicles were all that good. It was only when I was invited to speak on C.S. Lewis, and I thought, dear God, how can I do this with clean conscience? So I tried to find the strangest thing that he wrote that I could actually come to appreciate. It is interesting that as soon as you move out of C.S. Lewis's, his bestsellers, the ones at the top of the canonical list, as soon as you move away from that, it's stunning. I mean, it's really great stuff. So maybe I'm partly a sycophant, but, in a way that can be excused. C.S. Lewis's topic for his 1943 lectures was, quote, "The Abolition of Man, or Reflections on Education with Special Reference to the Teaching of English in Upper Forms of Schools." No joke. Now, given the somewhat, how should you put it, rarefied nature of the topic, Reflections on Education with Special Reference to Teaching of English in Upper Forms of School, and given the fact that this book emerged from a series of lectures that was delivered outside, away from his usual Oxbridge hunting grounds, it's little wonder that The Abolition of Man occupies such a minor place within C.S. Lewis's canon. And yet, I hope to convince you this evening that this minor place is unjustified. And if I can just give a hint about what's coming, The Abolition of Man was, of course, one of Pope Benedict's very favorite books. He quoted it at length in a number of different forms, probably the most extensive being a 1988 lecture that he delivered, the Fisher Lecture at Cambridge University, entitled Consumer Materialism and Christian Hope. And as I try to describe what C.S. Lewis was trying to do, if you know anything at all, which I assume you do, about the extraordinary theological effort of Pope Benedict, then you'll see, my word, there's some extraordinary convergence taking place here. In The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis devotes special attention to a small book, it's actually a textbook written for secondary English students, a complimentary copy of which had been sent to Lewis by the publisher. I suspect that publicist was shortly thereafter fired. Wishing at least to acknowledge the generous sentiment and perhaps to soften the blow that was about to come, Lewis decided to refrain from using the actual title of the book or naming its authors. Instead, he simply refers to The Green Book, written by two practicing schoolmasters that he calls Gaius and Titius after two Roman councils. The actual title of the book was The Control of Language. Please remember that as we go on. The Control of Language. And it was written by Alec King and Martin Kettler. Now, why should a secondary school textbook warrant such special attention? And why would a series of lectures about a secondary school textbook merit such an important inclusion, I think, in the responses that were made to what happens to Western culture once the tide of war recedes? Well, firstly, for Lewis, it was the pedagogical approach of Gaius and Titius that was symptomatic of what he describes as a whole system of values which happened to be in vogue among moderately educated young men of the professional classes during the period between the two wars. And Lewis should know about this system of values because he himself was one of these young men that bought into it. In his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis describes this system of values as the new look. The new look. Let me just flag at this point. Be attentive to references from here on in to look, sight, image, blind vision. I think you'll be interested by how often these ideas come up, and I'll tell you shortly why that's important. He described this faddish philosophical approach as the new look. The phrase itself is actually a lovely description that captures the idea that this outlook represented a particularly modern way of seeing the world, the new look. But also, this philosophical orientation represented a kind of intellectual fad or fashion, the new look. If we were being pretty technical, we'd probably call it maybe logical positivism, or because it came out of Oxford, maybe we could refer to it as Oxford realism. At bottom, this was the conviction that reality is nothing but a meaningless dance of atoms, that any sense of beauty or the sublime in nature is simply, quote, subjective phosphorescence, and of course that ethics are mere generalizations from affectional feelings. Lewis admitted that this view of the world was rather grim and meaningless, but nonetheless, he thought it represented a kind of wholesome severity. There was something nice and ascetical about it, by means of which humanity could dispossess ourselves of the cloying illusions of the past and escape the haze of subjective emotions and false feelings. But for Lewis, there was the added appeal that this Oxford realism went against the grain of the philosophical orthodoxy that prevailed in Oxford during this time, namely idealism. The conviction that mind and reality share something in common, or that what the mind knows, it knows truly. Hence, for Lewis, the wholesome severity of the new look satisfied a deep emotional need in himself. He writes, "I wanted nature to be quite independent of our observation. I wanted it to be something other, indifferent, self-existing." To his great dismay, however, Lewis confesses in Surprised by Joy, "Everything I had labored so hard to expel from my own life seemed to have flared up and met me in my best friends." Most gloriously devastating, of course, was the Anglican poet Owen Barfield, who, Lewis says, made quite short work of my chronological snobbery. I love that phrase, my chronological snobbery. The uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate common to our own age and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account discredited. Once that was done, once his chronological snobbery was overcome, once that was done, the moral and intellectual sterility of the new look could not help but collapse under its own logic. And so Lewis writes, "Unless I were to accept the unbelievable alternative, I must admit that my mind was no late-come epiphenomenon, that our logic was participation in a cosmic logos." Once Lewis made that admission, he would be led back inexorably to Christianity. And so I suppose the abolition of man represents a kind of final settling of accounts with the new look. Far from enabling him to see through illusions, the new look provided Lewis with a filter, a screen, which limited his ability to see what was right in front of him. As he would later write, "I must have been blind as a bat not to have seen long before the ludicrous contradiction between my theory of life and my actual experience." That's the first reason why Lewis takes up this fight rather robustly with Gaius and Titius and their little piece of human waste, the Green Book. But there is a second reason. It's relatively well known that Lewis nurtured a barely concealed disdain for schools. And not just schools, he actually rather hated teachers as well. Surely it's no coincidence that the diabolical Screwtape in the Screwtape Letters is portrayed in the position of a teacher over a rather suggestive pupil, Wormwood. Now, there's no doubt that Lewis's disdain for schools and teaching was thoroughly autobiographical, a sad reflection on his own experience at boarding schools, Malvern College in particular. And it was this that provided quite rich soil within which not only his own disdain could grow, but also for that opening chapter of the Silver Chair. You remember the chapter, the very beginning of the Silver Chair, the description of that horribly progressive school, where perversely it's the bullies of the school that get more attention from the headmasters because they become a kind of, you know, experiment. But I think this autobiographical side of things, his kind of visceral loathing of schools, is not the whole story. In fact, it's pretty clear that the depth of disdain that Lewis felt for schooling was inversely proportional to the importance that he imparted to schooling. Education, in fact, occupies a crucial place in Lewis's recasting of the relationship between the past, the present, and the future. It follows from his rejection of, remember, chronological snobbery, that Lewis would be absolutely opposed to the modern dogma of progress, a progressive emancipation from tradition, and a progressive control of natural resources, resulting in a continual increase of human power. We are abandoning tradition, we are embracing increased control over nature, that will lead to greater availability and exercise of human freedom. This emancipation from tradition, Lewis insists, does not make successive generations more free, but rather it makes them more subject to the conceits, the impairments, the moral disabilities of their predecessors. This is an extraordinary paragraph at all. Just a little bit long, but it's not too long. This is Lewis's brutalization of the progressive narrative. In order to fully understand what man's power over nature is, and therefore the power of some men over other men, we must picture the race extended in time from the date of its emergence to the date of its extinction. Each generation exercises power over its successors. Just imagine, instead of a progressive widening of the bounds of human freedom, you get his point. Each generation exercises power over each of its successive generations. Each generation exercises power over its successors, and each, insofar as it modifies the environment bequeathed to it and rebels against its previous tradition, resists and limits the power of its predecessors. There is, therefore, no question of a power rested in a race as a whole steadily growing as long as the race survives. The last men, far from being heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners, and will themselves exercise least power onto the future. I find this remarkable. He's saying that by abandoning tradition and what went before us, we don't become more free. We become progressively less free. We become progressively less free because we become progressively more enslaved to the conceits, the fickleness of the generation that went before. We don't inherit their strengths. We paradoxically, culturally inherit their weaknesses. We thereby become progressively impaired, not progressively liberated. And so he says, the last men will of all men be subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners. You notice then, Lewis's version of progressive freedom is in fact a perversion of freedom. It's freedom as cultural claustrophobia. It's freedom as impotence dressed up as its opposite. Now, these last men who are most subject to the dead hands of the great planners and conditioners, who are these great planners and conditioners? Well, among them, recall, this is all in the context of Lewis's critique of this wee little secondary school English textbook. These planners and conditioners who will exercise progressive control over successive generations, he names these as educators, eugenicists, scientists, magicians. By magicians, he means those who exercise control, power over nature. Recall W.H. Allen as well, the totalizing control of Caesarism. Now, it's this image that Lewis, instead of simply arguing, he actually lays it out in narrative form, not in The Abolition of Man, but in the third volume of Lewis's lesser-known fictional writings, the third volume of his so-called Ransom trilogy, called That Hideous Strength. I don't know if you've read That Hideous Strength. It's terrible. I mean, he was trying to find his sea legs, if I can put it this way, in terms of writing. It's awful. It's about two-thirds too long. But it's an interesting two-thirds too long. It's so bad that it actually makes it rather good. and I'll try to explain why. He was writing that hideous strength at the same time that he was conceiving of the abolition of man. In fact, in the preface to that hideous strength, he says, "This is a tall story about devilry, although behind it, it has a serious point, a point that I've tried to make in my abolition of man," just in case you didn't get the connection. Now, in that hideous strength, at the eye of the narrative storm of the book, is surely one of the most loathsome, pathetic characters ever constructed in modern fiction. A loathsome little twerp named Mark Studdock, who himself is aspiring junior academic specializing in social sciences, who is desperate, I mean, from the very first time that he's introduced in the book, he's desperate to find himself in an inner circle. It is interesting, by the way, how often this idea of an inner circle, a circle that you end up joining, and that they reinforce who you are, they affirm who you are, you feel perversely belonging in this group. He's desperate to belong to an inner circle, whether it be among these stuffy old academics at Bracton College, or in the more insidious National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, N-I-C-E, the National Institute. I mean, this catastrophic eugenicist doomsday organization called the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments. Fairly late in the novel, in the midst of the closest thing that Mark Studdock has to an epiphany, let me quote, this just gives you an idea how horrible he is. Then, after months and months, it finally happened. Studdock had a picture of himself, an odious little outsider who wanted to be an insider, an infantile gull drinking in the husky and unimportant confidences as if he were being admitted to the government of a planet. I don't know about you, I've worked with people like that. You know, I'm not going to recuse myself any further. Now, Studdock is, I mean, throughout the novel, he's an unbearable character to follow, and so much of the novel is actually devoted to him. It's devoted to his attempt, once he makes his way into this inner circle, it's actually, the rest of the novel is devoted to his attempt to escape from this inner circle. You could almost think of it as a kind of massively belabored science fiction version of Pilgrim's Progress. Instead of making, you know, Pilgrim making his way to the Celestial City, he's trying to make his way out of hell, and hell is the inner circle that he's struggled so hard to get into. There's nothing stopping him from leaving, technically. He just has to make a moral decision. And he keeps being confronted by this decision, but he's impaired. He's unable to make it. What's important about Mark Studdock for C.S. Lewis is that he is the personification of the last man. Let me show you how. It is a wonderful quote. "It must be remembered that in Mark's mind, hardly one rag of noble thought, either Christian or pagan, had a secure lodging. His education had been neither scientific nor classical, only modern. The severities both of abstraction and of high human tradition had passed him by. He had neither peasant shrewdness nor aristocratic honor to help him. He was a man of straw, a glob examinee in subjects that required no exact knowledge, and the first hint of any real threat to his bodily life knocked him sprawling." There's something quite funny about this. A little later in the novel, when faced with the decision that he has to make and finding himself simply incapable of making it, I mean, you know, quite literally, he is incapable of making this decision. Studdock explains quite pathetically, and again, this gives you a wonderful insight into just how pathetic a character he is. He says, "Damn, damn the whole thing, damn, damn. Why did he have such rotten heredity? Why had his education been so ineffective? Why was the system of society so irrational? Why was his luck so bad?" Studdock is left powerless before the glamorously endured but wanton nihilism of the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. He's left stammering and prevaricating before Professor Frost. Professor Frost is a caricature of H.G. Wells, driving quite seriously. He's left stammering and prevaricating in front of Professor Frost's assault on the whole world of subjective emotions, against his assault on the great majority of the human race, which cannot be trained into the total objectivity of mind, which is now necessary. It's little wonder that for the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, Studdock's utter moral impairment makes him ideally suited to one task, and one task only, that of being a journalist. At one point, Ransom remarks to Merlin, yes, that Merlin, they have an engine, you see, called the press, whereby all people are deceived. In essence, I should just point out that Lewis is actually fully adopting here Hilaire Belloc's great critique of the press, of the popular press, as keeping in place the modern mind. Hilaire Belloc described the modern mind as this toxic mix of ignorance, pride, and sloth. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything more about that. He was right. Of course he was right. Now, the point that Lewis is actually trying to make by, on the one hand, portraying Mark Studdock as so obviously formed by a deficient educational system, and at the same time, this production by an obviously deficient educational system equipping him only to do one thing, and that is to be a journalist. The point is that education belongs to this process of gradual, inexorable constriction, where things keep sharpening and reaching a hard and narrow point, a point that ultimately forces everybody to make a decision. And yet these last men themselves are incapable of making that decision. Just to draw my final parallel with W.H. Auden, it is interesting, of course, that shortly after the feudal course, you know, the great Caesar, he has conquered seven kingdoms, the prophet Simeon who comes in and visits Christ, the prophet Simeon interrupts and says, the word could not be made flesh until men had reached a state of absolute contradiction between clarity and despair, in which they would have no choice but either to accept absolutely or to reject absolutely. For C.S. Lewis, modern education is the absolute precondition for the production of men of straw like Mark Studdock. Now, this brings me back to the significance of the abolition of man in our time. C.S. Lewis writes, the very power of Gaius and Titius depends on the fact that they are dealing with a boy who thinks he is simply doing his English prep and has no notion that theology, philosophy, politics, ethics, are all at stake. It is not a theory that they put in his mind, but an assumption. An assumption which 10 years hence, its origin forgotten and its presence unconscious, will condition him to take one side in a controversy which he never realized was a controversy at all. The stated goal of the Green Book, you see, was to teach students to see through things, to dismiss the control exerted by illusion and language upon emotion. Gaius and Titus want their students to see through the rhetoric of so-called value, bound up as it is with the chains of the past, the apparent oppressions of tradition, of family, of nation, and authority. They want to free their students from the control of language, and hence of outmoded morality, and instead place their students in control of language. You see the double-edged sword of the title of the book, The Control of Language. They want their students to be able to make up their own minds, independent of social, political, familial, or religious authority. Whenever I read that bit in Lewis's book, I can't help but think that Christian ethicist Stanley Hauerwas has this wonderful line when he critiques, I mean, truly the worst movie ever made, surely, is Dead Poets Society. I mean, can you imagine any more willfully nihilistic movie than Dead Poets Society, which encourages students to make up their own minds? Seriously. That is a recipe for worldwide cataclysm. Stanley Hauerwas has this wonderful thing. I cannot think of a more conformist and suicidal message in modernity than that we should encourage students to make up their own minds before they have minds worth making up. According to C.S. Lewis, Gaius and Titius see the world around them as in the sway of emotional propaganda, and they conclude that the best thing that they can do is to fortify the minds of young people against false emotion. But Lewis says they thereby misdiagnosed the times. They've gotten the problem wrong. For Lewis says, for every one pupil who needs to be guarded from a weak excess of sensibility, there are three who need to be awakened from the slumber of cold vulgarity. The task of the modern educator, Lewis says, is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. The best counterpoint to false feeling isn't no feeling or cynical feeling, but truth, real feeling. Now, at this point, Lewis can't quite conceal his grumpiness towards modern youth. He refers to them incessantly as trousered apes and urban blockheads. And yet, Lewis says, basically, until modern times, all teachers, even all men, believed that the universe was in such a way that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous with the universe. In other words, there were certain emotional reactions that resonated with the grain of the universe. And there are other emotional reactions that are out of step with the grain of the universe. In other words, emotions respond to what is there. They need, however, to be shaped. They can be shaped to respond to merit. They can be shaped to disapprove of what is evil. And then at this point, beginning with St. Augustine's notion of the ordo amoris, the ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded the degree of love that's owing to it. And then moving on to Aristotle's conception that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. This is what is good. Love this. This is what is bad. Run from this. This is what is good. Feel joyful towards this. This is what is bad. Feel viscerally loathing towards that. He then moves on from Augustine Aristotle to Hinduism's notion of Rata, or cosmic moral order, and then to Plato's notion of the transcendental good, then to the Jewish conception of Torah as moral order, as the very blueprint of creation, and then finally to the Chinese Tao, the way which every man should tread in imitation of that cosmic or supercosmic progression. Lewis stitches these things together to recover what he calls the one thing without which we cannot live. A doctrine of subjective value. The belief that certain attitudes are really true and that other attitudes are really false. True and false to the kind of thing that the universe is and the kind of things that we are. Without this notion of subjective value, Lewis says, all we are left with is the nihilism of bare choice. And so he writes, when everything that is in us that said it is good has been taken away, all that remains is I want. When it is good is gone, all that's left is I want. I should say that this is the reason why to the final year of his life, Lewis stayed true to the medieval image of the universe, not as all things revolving around the sun, but rather the order of the universe above human life. He says this is the order of the universe, which, though factually false, is imaginatively nourishing. This is an image of the universe that is structured around the infinite rhythms of divine love. He says all philosophers, all artists of the medieval Renaissance period indulged in this because no other model was so imaginatively thrilling, so emotionally satisfying. It's worth noting, this is a huge digression, any imagination of the universe can't help but be anthropocentric. Any imagination of the universe is a reflection of what we believe about ourselves. If we believe that we are knit together by the infinite love of God, then the universe will resonate with that same vision. If, however, we believe that there is no impediment to our will, that there is nothing that we have been born into, that there is nothing that we have received that in any way stands in the way of us exercising our free choice, then the universe accordingly will take that same shape. I often suspect that that's the reason why popular science writing was as popular as it is today. It's not because it's describing the universe out there, but rather it's describing the universe in which there is nothing that stands in the way of us saying that I want. The crucial thing for Lewis is that without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal body, the animal organism. Lewis says that it's this middle element of trained emotions by which man is man. For it's by his intellect that he is mere spirit, and by his appetite he is mere animal. But by his chest, Lewis says, he is man. According to the more ancient parlance, the head is the cerebral, the belly is the visceral. It is the chest where the emotions are organized and trained by habit into stable sentiments. Effectively, Lewis says, modern education of the sort championed by Gaius and Titius is creating men without chests, narcissistically enclosed and devoid of fertile and generous emotion. And so in an incredibly memorable description, Lewis says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, education removes the organ but demands the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find that there are traitors in our midst. We castrate and then bid the geldings be fruitful. It's rather difficult when reading this idea of a kind of progressive educational impairment not to think of one of the most haunting portrayals, I think, in the entirety of Lewis's Narnia Chronicles. You recall at the end of the last battle, remember something has gone terribly wrong in Narnia, and the last remaining inhabitants of Narnia go pouring through the stable door. You remember that? Only to discover that inside Narnia there is a wider Narnia still. It's like the TARDIS. You know? It's bigger on the inside. The inhabitants go through. They're luxuriating in what lie on the other side. It says they stood on the grass. The deep blue sky was overhead. The air which blew gently on their face was that of a day in early summer. But then Lucy notices odd behavior of the dwarves. Quote, they weren't strolling about or enjoying themselves, nor were they lying down and having a rest. Instead, the dwarves were sitting very close together in a little circle, facing one another, recall the inner circle. They neither looked around nor took any notice of the humans until Lucy and Tyrion were almost close enough to touch them. Then the dwarves all cocked their heads as if they couldn't see anyone, but were listening hard, trying to guess by sound what was happening. Look out, said one of them in a surly voice. Mind where you're going. Don't walk into our faces. All right, said Eustace indignantly. We're not blind. We've got eyes in our heads. They must be darn good ones if you can see in here, said the same dwarf, whose name was Diggle. In where? Asked them. Why, you boneheaded, here, of course, said Diggle. In this pitch black, pokey, smelly little hole in the stable. Are you blind? Said Tyrion. Ain't we all blind in the dark? Said Diggle. But it isn't dark, you poor, stupid dwarf, said Lucy. Can't you see? Look up! Look round, can't you see the sky and the trees and the flowers? Can't you see me? You've been picking up throughout so far the importance of vision and blindness for Lewis, haven't you? The new look, which finally is a form of blindness. The new look, which is facilitated by a tight-knit group of supposedly rebel philosophers, but instead is a form of tight-knit dwarvish blindness. How in the name of all humbug can I see what ain't there? And how can I see you any more than you can see me in this pitch blackness, says Diggle. The children are terribly upset by this, and they turn to Aslan to do something for the dwarves. Aslan sadly shows the children both what I can and cannot do by laying out a sumptuous feast before the dwarves, which they immediately begin to devour, which all the while suspecting that they were eating the sorts of things that one might find in a stable. You can only imagine fine and stable. Because it was clear that these dwarves, not only could they not see, but they couldn't taste properly. Soon they began to grow very suspicious, one after the other. And the dwarves began suspecting that the other one had the better sort of food than they themselves were eating. So a fight broke out, ruining the food and leaving the dwarves bloody and bruised. They nonetheless congratulated themselves on their cunning. "Well, at any rate, there's no humbugging here. We haven't let anyone take us in. The dwarves are for the dwarves." "You see," said Aslan, "they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own minds, and yet they are in that prison. Listen, they are so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out." If we had the time, we would follow this thread. This ends up intersecting with precisely C.S. Lewis's critique of the way in which love begins to be expressed in the same environment. Lewis, and I tend to think that there's a good deal of Lewis's influence in the way that Bendick ended up writing about this in Deus Caritas Est, but Lewis critiques specifically George Orwell's fascination, not with Eros, which all feels a little bit too much out of control, but rather with sheer old animal sex. Lewis says that the problem with Orwell's and the modern conception of love is that it's fascinated by it. It's narcissistically enclosed in on itself. Lewis says Eros is about the other. Modern love is about itself. Wrap things up very briefly. I'm going to be publishing this later, so you can get the rest soon. But what strikes me about what Lewis does here, and the way that this ends up resonating quite precisely with what Benedict would end up arguing again and again about what's happened to a Western culture that has mistaken freedom for freedom from obligation, is that this notion of freedom that Lewis critiques, this notion of freedom that Benedict then critiques, is fundamentally a freedom which is enclosed in on itself. In its very belief that it's opened itself up into the wider world and genuine choice, what it is in fact doing is turning itself further and further inward, and so taking on the form of its opposite. The great American pastoralist poet Wendell Berry said, "This is the fundamental problem with modern times. We have liberated fantasy. We have killed imagination. And so have sealed ourselves in selfishness and loneliness." If we had a little bit more time, I might have been a little bit more efficient. We would note that one of the extraordinary things that Benedict keeps following through is the importance of not just obligation in terms of our obligations one to another, but that once we simply acknowledge our obligations one to another, if we can refer to it as horizontal obligations with one to another, then that same process of self-enclosure, much like Lewis's critique of the inner circle, can become operative in our own communities. They can simply become narcissistic, self-enclosed communities, which is why Benedict says again and again, those communities, while acknowledging their obligations one to another, must also acknowledge their obligations and communion to truth. To truth. And it's that which ensures that communities aren't simply narcissistically self-enclosed. Benedict then followed this very precise argument, begins to argue quite specifically in 1969, really begins making this point in the late 80s and early 90s. It comes through quite extraordinarily in his three encyclicals, where what the Eucharist then does is it feeds sight beyond sight. The Eucharist and the whole practice of the patient gaze upon Christian art, upon the icons, this grants, effectively, it converts the imagination. It allows the imagination to go from simply self-centered introspection, or it allows the imagination to go from the mere consumption of images One of the great problems, it seems to me, that we have today is that our society is awash, our medium is awash with images. And yet we believe that those images are, in fact, kind of real presence. By seeing an image, we are actually participating in this true contact with what's on the other side of that image. And yet you notice that no sooner do we view images today, then we are, A, guarded from those images. If we don't want to look, we don't have to look. In other words, we can sever the bond of obligation. Or we can do something far more perfidious. This is the third part of my little paper, not so little paper. The other thing that we do with these images is that we acknowledge a kind of false obligation. There's a media analyst who I love because he writes like a philosopher, but his topic is social media. He says that this is essentially what could be called slacktivism. Slacktivism. You're confronted with an image, a cause, some international eruption, and you feel really worked up about it. This is imposing itself upon your moral conscience. This is beginning to stir up certain feelings about obligation and human responsibility and what ethical response what might I make. So what do? You retweet it. Or you like it. And by doing that, you're doing a little bit to make the world a better place. But what you've in fact done is by consuming something, by consuming this story, by consuming and discarding this image, you fundamentally brought it into your orbit rather than soldering the bonds of actual responsibility. And so Benedict points out that there is a vast difference between viewing an image, consuming, discarding it, and patiently gazing upon, for instance, an icon of the Ascension, a sacred image of the Resurrection, which, by viewing it, it shapes your capacity to feel properly. It trains your emotions, but more importantly, it converts your imagination. It seems to me there's never been a more important time than our time, which is so awash with idolatrous images, to embrace once again the importance of education, of Eucharistic observance, of patient gazing, of a kind of fast for the eyes of people, upon this fresh deliberate process whereby our imaginations themselves are given eyes to see and hopefully then ears to hear.
That was Scott Stevens speaking on Resisting the Pedagogy of Dwarves. Scholarship in the Cathedral is run each Friday during Lent in the crypt of St. Mary's Cathedral in Sydney. For details, you can follow the links on the Cradio website. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.
Cradio.org.au.